Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.com. .org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the free enterprise system when we come back. Hey, are you concerned about your privacy? Well, how much does your government know about you anyway, and how much do you want your government to know about you? Well, government only knows as much about you as you tell them about yourself, and everything that government, industry, or business knows about you is because you told them. Now, the Fourth Amendment protects you in your person, houses, papers, and effects, but it does not protect you from yourself. Now, can we have privacy in the computer age? Well, the answer is yes, we can. And that's because information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. It's knowing how this information is gathered, what information is being stored, and what information you want to keep personal and private that actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. So always keep in mind that no one knows anything about you that you haven't revealed by your own hand or by your own mouth. Now, if you'd like to learn more about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call and ask for our free general law CD package first? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour program, and it's entertaining, it's informational, it's educational, and best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our webpage, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget? The free enterprise system. What is it? We Americans like to talk a lot about our capitalist system and how it is far superior to fascism and Nazism, communism. We call it capitalism. But what is it? Where does it come from? And how do you use it? You know, we survive or we die, and that's called life and death. Well, to survive, we must consume. And to consume, we must produce. And to produce, we confront our most critical survival problem, and it's called scarcity. Scarcity. So how do we overcome scarcity? And that's called economics. And that's why economics is the life science. It's one of those life sciences that we deal with every day. And economics is the allocation of scarce resources. And what we need is the best system to overcome scarcity. Now, we've all heard that cows give milk, but that's not true. Cows don't give milk. You and I have to take that milk away from them. Now, Mother Nature is equally stingy with her vast, abundant resources. We have to work hard to find those resources. Then, to get those resources and to keep getting them, we have to keep working and working hard. It takes labor to find those resources and develop them. But if we use our hearts and spirits to properly exert mind, muscle, and machines, Mother Nature will open up her ample resources to allow mankind not only to survive, but to prosper. Prosperity. For not only subsistence, but also for abundance. abundance. I always liken it to communists stand in line to share the shortage. Capitalists don't stand in line to enjoy abundance. Now, let's take a look at the design of a system: freedom, free enterprise, and government. So how do we go about designing a bounteous, productive, generous, prosperous society? What does it take to get people to work hard, to work willingly, to work loyally, even work enthusiastically to produce a low-cost, high-quality surplus so that they can exchange and thrive? Those are the kinds of questions that America's founding fathers addressed. And it started with government. But why government? Well, Warren Hackett addressed these questions in From Freedom to Free Enterprise. And here's what he said. The new government that resulted was dedicated to protecting the God-given right of freedom for each citizen. This new political climate brought into being what we now call the free enterprise economic system, which is the way that we produce things that we want and we need. Under this free enterprise system, in our first 100 years, we became the freest and most prosperous people on earth. It attracted the ancestors of most of us, who were seeking at that time freedom from oppressive, tyrannical governments in their old countries, and it spurred them to settle here in the United States. Now, Hackett discussed the function and the role of government in relation to free enterprise. He said, ever since government came into being, whether by seizure of power to rule or by consent of the government or the governed, there has been a constant conflict between the governed and the government. Politicians who operate governments produce none of the food or goods that people need and want. In short, government produces nothing. The original concept and the function of government was a central agency organized to protect people from crime at home and from foreign enemies abroad. Nothing more, nothing less. But from the beginning of history, the greatest threat to man's freedom and property always has been his own government. The governed are the producers. Those who govern take from the producers, with or without their consent, little or much of their production by taxation in order to support that government, and in many cases, to enrich the rulers. Now, historically, the minority which governs always seeks more and more power to control and take more from those that are being governed. So who are the majority? Well, the majority is made up of the producers, and the minority is made up of the consumers. Now, both the producers and consumers are consumers. Everybody consumes, but not everybody produces. And their reason always is, they claim, at least in government, it's for the good of the people. We are here for the good of the people, the government says. Well, any government control, whether it's legitimate or not, involves some loss of individual freedom. Governments control people by making laws. These laws, which are the rules by which they must abide or suffer punishment, and laws can be just or they can be unjust. If these laws protect each individual's freedom to act in a constructive manner that harms no one, then they're called just laws. If these laws are arbitrary, or they restrict or deny this freedom to the individual, they're called unjust. So just or unjust government alone has the power to punish those who break its laws. Now, depending upon what kind of government, the type and enforcement of laws, and the extent to which this government protects or usurps individual freedom, the nature and workings of a free or not so free enterprise system determines our circumstances, our destiny, and our prosperity. Clarence Carson answers the question, what is free enterprise? He said, quote, the free enterprise is a way of going about meeting our needs and wants by providing those needs and wants ourselves or by freely entering into transactions with others. It is free insofar as it does not entail the use or threat of force by any person or organization or deception by either of these. Now, the opposite of free enterprise is hampered, restricted, controlled, or prohibited enterprise. Whether regulations promote or inhibit enterprise depends upon the particular regulations. Enterprise must be conducted according to rules, but if the rules inhibit entry or hamper free activity, they become restrictions on free enterprise. And Carson hits on something very important. It's how we get what we want and need. And there is every reason to believe that man is naturally inclined to be economic. That is, man is naturally inclined to use as little energy and to consume and use as little material to produce as many goods as he can from them. If this were not the case, it is easy to believe that he would long since have perished from the face of the earth. So we all want to produce as much as possible with as little energy expended as we can. And he tells that there are two ways that you can get what you want. You can provide for yourself or you can acquire from others. You can get things in two ways. They can be given to you as a gift or they can be taken by you by force. So let's look at this. I can give you something. I can buy, sell, trade, and give you something that's called a gift, or I can come to you and I can take it. Now, we have a law, a very old law, says thou shalt not steal. Governments have been instituted among us to prevent other people from coming over and violently taking from us that which we create and produce. That's why we have policemen out there on the streets. It's to protect us and our property from somebody that might come and take it from us. Now, it is this latter option that raises Hobbes in determining what is economic. So, strictly speaking, robbery could be very economical for any given individual, because by stealing, an individual can greatly augment the supply of his goods and services that are available to him with only a very little expenditure of energy and material. For instance, a bank robber may, for example, spend half an hour, use a $20 gun, and enrich himself, say, to the extent of $20,000. Now, that's about $40,000 an hour. That's very economical. Now, that might indeed be economical for that individual, but it is not necessarily economical for society at large. Economics has to do with the increase of goods, not only of individuals, but of those that are generally available. So the bank robber augments his personal supply at the expense of those from whom he has stolen. And moreover, he may reduce the general supply further by the threat that he poses to trade and the loss of incentive that people have to produce when they're uncertain that they will be able to keep the rewards of their labor. And for these reasons, theft should not be considered economical or a part of economics. Even so, the example of the bank robber is not frivolous. All redistribution schemes are proposals to use and to use force to take from those who have and to give to those who do not have. If governments do this, it is not at all clear why it is still not theft, albeit we call it legal theft. and its effect on the general supply would reasonably be the same as any other kind of theft. So when government comes in and takes by taxation from you, it's a theft. Well, did you want to give, or is it being taken by threat and force? Now, there's a magic ingredient here of free enterprise that makes it work. And the question then becomes, how do we best use our hearts and spirits to properly exert mind, muscle, and machines? Well, the answer is subtle, but it's very profound. Human nature is such that we work hard and produce abundantly for our own very personal and sometimes mysterious reasons. The degree to which we produce determines our material existence and life quality. The degree to which we produce is the degree to which we are free and to which we exercise our freedom with responsibility. In other words, we do well what we like to do. And when we do what we like to do, we do more of it and we do it better. It becomes free enterprise when what we do, in the sense of making a living, contributes to our economic system in the creation and exchange of wealth. And Hackett explores the laws of nature to which the founders referred to in the Declaration of Independence, whereby people must work and produce if they are to survive, survival being the first law of nature. Now, the founders knew that government, which is man-made and operated institutions, can give the people absolutely nothing that it has first not taken away from them in the beginning. So government has nothing to give you. In order for government to give you something, they had to first take it away from somebody else to give it to you. Name one thing that government produces. Are they producing automobiles? Airplanes? Are they producing meat, milk, butter, and eggs? What government institution do you call that? Now, our founding fathers also knew that government produces nothing. Government consumes much. Government is expensive. Big government is a big expense. Big government steals a lot. Every tax is a theft without choice. Monopoly is theft. Government is a monopoly. What are my choices? Government limits choices. Free enterprise expands choices. And they came up, finally, with a system of financing government by choice. Now, that was a wild new idea. Financing government by choice. Today we finance government by tax, and every tax is a theft, unless it's done by choice. Did you choose to file and pay your income tax? Well, if you did, then you had a choice. And if you didn't, well, then you didn't have a choice. It's just that simple. So the founding fathers financed our federal government with import and export taxes. It was a simple system. If the French, let's say, want to sell their wine here in the United States, then our federal government would impose a tax upon the French. If the Frenchman wants to sell his wine in California and compete with the wine growers in the Napa Valley, they have to pay a tax, which brings the price of their product up to or exceeding that of the producer here in the United States. That would finance government and protect the local growers or the local producers in the Napa Valley. Government was there to protect the citizens of the United States, not to enrich or protect the citizens of France. Now, that's a wild and novel idea. Now, today, we like to talk about free trade. And free trade is wonderful for the French, for them to sell wine in California. But what in the hell does it do for the wine growers of California? Now, it enriches somebody. I mean, we didn't come up with these tax and spend policies the government comes up with for no good reason. But whether or not they benefit you or I is another question, and we ought to examine that question. That's what free enterprise is all about. Freedom of speech is an important part of this thing called free enterprise. Now, Dr. Cleon Skousen highlights Adam Smith's classic work called Wealth of Nations to say that Smith distinguished between gold and silver money and wealth, the latter being the essentials of life, such as food, clothes, housing, factories, school, roads, farms. And he said, if you wanted to raise the standard of living where people truly prosper, goods and services must be abundant and they must be cheap. This included specialized production and buying and selling in a free market, where supply and demand are served by people voting with their money. Incentives are profit or prospect of profit, and such a system results in products being manufactured in higher quantity and quality at lower expense and prices. The threat to all of this is government interference in fixing prices, wages, controlling production or distribution, and subsidizing some production while taxing others. The government, serving only as referee, is to prevent force, fraud, monopoly, and perversity. Let me repeat that. The government, serving only as a referee, is there to prevent force, to prevent fraud, to prevent monopoly, and to prevent perversity. And Skousen summarizes Adam Smith's tremendously successful formula for prosperity in the following natural laws of economic principles, which included four freedoms. And the four freedoms in free enterprise are, it's the freedom to try, the freedom to buy, the freedom to sell, and the freedom to fail. These four freedoms work based upon people behaving sensibly in the resulting free market economy at the various levels, individual, family, township, county, state, and national. And also, each level of the system had to be self-governing, self-sustaining, and self-repairing. So, a simple model of free enterprise works like this. What is free enterprise, and how does free enterprise work? Well, the concept of free enterprise is not immediately obvious. First of all, nothing is free. There's no such thing as a free lunch. Everything costs something because scarce resources must be processed by smart, hardworking, self-sacrificing, other-serving people to be useful and available. And similarly, there's no such thing as free enterprise. To have free enterprise, we have to have freedom. And millions have fought and died for this thing that we call freedom, the freedom to act unmolested. We must set up the best economic, political, cultural, and governmental system possible to allow the most freedom available and to protect and enforce that freedom. Thereby, people flourish. So free enterprise is a two-word phrase with a third implied. The less obvious missing ingredient is called risk. And here's the triangle of free enterprise. It's risk, work, and freedom. So if we have freedom to work with the free enterprise system, then we have to assume the risk that comes from it. Now, free enterprise is freedom to work with risk, and it's freedom with risk, work with risk, freedom to work and take a risk. We have freedom of choice to work and to enjoy the satisfaction or not to work and suffer the consequences. When we exercise our freedom to work or create enterprise, we take a risk. If we're smart, we minimize the risk by being better prepared, better educated, more experienced. And we carefully consider what we like and what we want to do, and it needs to be done, and how we need to do it, and what will benefit others, and what will reward us, and what will reward us with profit with minimal risk of failure. So risk is the ever-present player in the drama of life. And the part that some business people forget is risk. In a going business, we're intent on how much profit we make, not on whether and how we make that profit. Risk is the disciplinary part with dual possibilities. It has the possibility of profit or the possibility of loss, the possibility of success or the possibility of failure, the possibility of reward or the possibility of punishment. Now, when we lose sight of these possibilities, we do what we've always done. If we keep doing what we've always done, we'll keep getting what we've always gotten. And let's suppose we keep on making better slide rules or spring-powered balance wheel watches. What happens, even though we make a better one more cheaply, how about buggy whips, wagon wheels, and candles? These were once guaranteed to make money. But now they're losers. And they're losers because they're obsolete. They've been superseded by something better, something cheaper, something that people want. In free enterprise, where the creativity of the human mind and spirit is unleashed, progress is fast. Change is certain and it's guaranteed. If we know this and we react to it, we always consider risk in our thinking and prepare for it. And eventually, we create the future, and not merely react to the whims of fate and fortune. The free enterprise system is dynamic and it's constantly changing. Instead of being alarmed to find businesses going out of business, we should understand that the system is working just the way it was intended and the way that it must work. If we recognize the dynamic character of free enterprise, then we all prosper with it. So, what's the dynamic character of free enterprise? Well, let's consider for a moment business formation and failures. In 1988, 685,000 new businesses were formed, while 57,000 businesses failed. Ever-changing, rearranging free enterprise rewards those who work hard, innovate, keep up with competition, continue to please customers, and make a profit. Dynamic change is normal. And though we lament about failed businesses, especially for people who lose their jobs, that's the way the system works. Long-lasting businesses are the exception. They are not the rule. So a Sears or a General Motors is an exception. It's not the general rule of free enterprise. Now, if you know the dynamic character and ever-changing demands of free enterprise, you're in a position of power. You can make decisions to take advantage of the system, and your knowledge of it is to prepare for the future. And you can make it work for you, and you get more out of it by putting more into it. Enterprising individuals who keep abreast of changes react constructively. They complete high school or go beyond high school. Some to trade school, some to business or community colleges, while others enter apprenticeship programs. Some on the fast track go to college, not for one, but two college degrees or two majors. Or they may use one degree in one field and get actual experience and go back for an advanced degree in the field of their choice. Now, while working, they take advantage of seminars, workshops, trade shows, professional and trade associations to upgrade their skills, to advance their knowledge, and more importantly, make valuable people contacts. And they live more realistic, positive, and confident lives as a result. They learn to recognize the important universal characteristics of enterprise, people, markets, and products. They learn the specialties in each area and always have a job. They keep abreast of changes and trends to stay welcome and rewarded by the system. The time and energy that we invest today prepare us for the rapid changing world of tomorrow. Besides that, it's fun. Now, many individuals cannot plan their careers but they slide into a job because mom or granddad or grandfather, they did it, and only to find the job goes away, like coal mines. Many jobs were lost in the 70s and 80s when the trend developed towards smaller automobiles, each using hundreds of pounds less steel. Foreign car competition affected not only auto industry, but the steel industry and mining as well. The same was true for plastics, aluminum, and glass. Another example is energy. You know, for decades, when energy was abundant and prices were low, we became wasteful. Then scarcity was imposed by a free cartel, and we were forced to become frugal, to install conservation measures, to markedly reduce demand while still maintaining our standard of living. We applied free enterprise principles then to achieve higher energy self-sufficiency. These job areas, once so secure, dwindled while others grew, and that's the way free enterprise works. Now, the way it is our basis of reality. We can know all of this, use it, and benefit by it, or we can ignore it and then suffer the consequences. So the choice is ours. The real world changes. We here in America have the most efficient, fair, though not perfect, economic system that recognizes and uses basic human nature to work and to produce. It meets our needs through inevitable change. With our needs met, we now have new abundance to share. Well, let me give you a reminder here at the halfway point, and we'll take a look at this free enterprise system. We're reading from the Foundations of Liberty, the free enterprise system, which is put out by the Foundations of Liberty. Foundations of Liberty are located in the MacArthur Institute, 946th Avenue, East Moline, Illinois. The zip code is 61244. James R. Patrick is the editor. It's called Foundations of Liberty, and we are looking at free enterprise. All right. I got to remind you here that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. In the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that those authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and editorial review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the free enterprise system. It's an unusual process. It comes from the Ten Commandment model. It was instituted at Mount Sinai by Moses. We Americans have been practicing this free enterprise system from about 1787 until about 1933. Beginning in 1933, we began to make a radical change from this free enterprise system to the fascist system. And we call it capitalism. It's actually better described as fascism, or a government big business partnership, which creates wealth for some at the expense of many. The Germans tried this. They called it Nazism. The Italians tried it, and they called it fascism. And there are all these isms out there that people use to apply to government to see if government can't create a system that will produce more and alleviate the scarcity, which is the natural status of economy. The natural status of economy is scarcity. There is a shortage. There are not nearly as many Rolls Royces out there as we would like to see. And so as a result of that, the price of Rolls Royces is something more than a Datsun. That's what the bottom line is all about. There are better automobiles and better airplanes and more food, and there's better cuts of meat. And the better cuts of meat are scarce. Filet mignon is more rare than is hamburger. And that's why more people eat hamburger than eat filet mignon. Now, if we want more filet mignon, then we have to produce more beef. And if we produce more beef, we're going to produce more hamburger. And that's why the hamburger is cheaper than the filet mignon, because it's in greater supply. It's just that simple, just supply and demand. So we reduce this to what we call supply and demand. What is the demand for the supply? Well, right now the demand for buggy whips is very minimal. And the demand for tires is a lot higher. And so people that produce tires will get a bigger and better reward and more dependable reward than people who are producing buggy whips. And that's just where reality is located. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't some buggy whip makers and that there aren't some wagon wheel makers and the buggy builders. There are a few of those out there. But they're not in as great a demand as the automobile builders. There's more people out there that want to buy automobiles. And there's fewer people that want to buy Rolls Royces than there are people who want to buy Datsuns and Toyotas. So there's a supply and demand equation that comes into this thing called free enterprise. Now, some important characteristics of free enterprise work like this. With economic freedom, the basic touchstone of free enterprise, remember, economic freedom is the basic touchstone of free enterprise. These basic characteristics make it work. Number one is private property. Number two, self-interest. Number three, customer sovereignty. Number four, competition. Number five, a free market. And number six, limited government. So if you've got private property, a self-interest, customer integrity, competition, free market, and a limited government, you can have economic freedom. So economic freedom then provides the right to choose, then abundance and surplus. It's that freedom to choose, which is the characteristic of free enterprise. Economic freedom is essential for all of the other freedoms. The less economic freedom that you have, the less you have of your other freedoms: political, religious, intellectual, social, personal. Freedom is a total package. If you restrict one, you reduce all. Private property. Thou shalt not steal, now, is the guarantor of private property. Now, we enjoy our right to choose what we do to make a living. But human nature is such that we work harder when we know that what we create and produce is rightfully ours to keep. We can keep it or exchange it as we judge best. This condition allows us to work as long, hard, and smart as we wish, especially if we reap all of the rewards for our efforts and sacrifice. So let's use chairs and me, the chair maker, as an example. I'm a chair maker who makes sturdy, comfortable, high-quality chairs. I build and sell my chairs, and yet I'm unable to keep up with demand. So one day a big, tough character visits me to offer protection, and I explain that I don't need protection. My product, my quality, service, and fair dealings have protected me against all of the foreseeable hazards of the marketplace. And he says, all but one. He says, you need to be protected from me. So he crashes one of my finished chairs down upon another and destroys both chairs. So I ask him what he means by protection, and he explains to me that I must provide him with one chair out of every 20 chairs that I produce, or this damage will occur again and again and again. Now, looking at the two destroyed chairs, it's obviously worth that amount, so I agree. And I've been coerced by threat of force and violence to give up some of my product to protect the rest of it. Now, how long will one chair out of 20 continue my protection, and how ethical and moral is subscribing to such a service? How many others pay for the same protection? Well, a better solution might be to provide the one chair tax to institute a governmental unit funded equally by all producers, to protect themselves and all members of society. I call this a police force and designate its function to keep the peace, provide for the public safety and security, and to ensure law and order for all of the citizens against those who would abuse the freedoms and rights of others. So with the police force in place to protect our freedoms and rights, we have effectively protected all private property. I can again pour all of my energies into what I like to do, which serves others as well. And that is how government helps create a climate of creating wealth. So now, instead of paying one chair out of 20 to the extortioner, I pay one chair out of 20 to the government to protect me from the extortioner. So the loss is the same. It costs me either one, the thief and extortioner is going to come in and take it from me. That's the mafia. Or two, I got to pay it to the police to have them protect me from the mafia. In which case, for practical purposes, it doesn't make any difference. But for every 20 chairs that I make, I've got to give one to somebody, and I get to keep the other 19. All right, so now it's a given, isn't it? Now, we come into what we call self-interest. In a free enterprise society, it's almost impossible to serve oneself without serving others, and that's probably pretty good. It's equally impossible to enjoy a high standard of living without specializing in what you do best and exchanging with others doing what they do best to fill your wants and needs. So I think to myself, well, let someone else bake the bread, pick the apples, and get them to market. I will supply the best chairs that money can buy. Now, in this posture, I can work as long and as hard as I wish. If I produce more, I can enjoy more. I can have more leisure time, more wealth or peace of mind. I can expand my business and hire others. I can start related businesses. I can go out of business. I can go on vacation, or I can stay at home. But whatever I decide to do, I do it for my own reasons. And in every case, if it doesn't serve others, I can't make a living doing it. If I'm out taking a vacation, then I'm not making chairs. I'm consuming my production rather than producing. but I accept full responsibility. I exercise my freedoms prudently and honorably. I work hard, and I flourish in the fruits of my labor. I'm in control. I'm happy. Now, how much more incentive and motivation can one person have? Well, isn't it great to live in a free enterprise society? So let's take a look at customer sovereignty. Now, the customer pays the bill. The customer is the boss. And here's how that works. In a free enterprise economy, for our very own reasons, we wish to enrich ourselves by pleasing others. This works only if others are enriched by what we do. The more good we do, the more others are pleased, and the more successful we are as a result. So what others do has value to us as well, and we're willing to pay for that. That's part of the magic of free enterprise. We are in the people-pleasing business. The customer is the king, the queen, the pharaoh, the reigning monarch. In short, the customer is the boss. Now, when you please the boss, good things happen to you. In pleasing the big boss, the customer, you please yourself as well, and you are rewarded for doing that, both in satisfaction and in money, and return for your risk and hard work. So we begin this discussion with one of the hardest facts of life. Either we consume or we die. We are all consumers. But we are not all producers. Now, customers pay for what they consume. For instance, while children are consumers, they aren't always producers. Their parents or providers are the customers, the producers. They earn the living and pay the bills. Public education is a good example. Parents work and pay taxes to fund school systems. They're the customers because they pay the bills. Some adults no longer have children in school. They're also customers for education. Some property taxpayers don't have children, yet they are too also customers for public education. The students are the consumers of education. So when we consider who does all the hard work and who takes all of the risks, it's important to differentiate between consumers and customers, especially assessing the results of government programs, funding, and spending, similar to public education. But even in these, the customer, the bill payer, and taxpayer is sovereign. Understanding the definition of sovereign is important to understand free enterprise. It means superior to or above all others. It is the chief or greatest, supreme in authority. It's the rank or the power, holder of power. It's the ruler. So, as sovereign customers, we can feel good about living in a free enterprise economy in America, and the same feeling we have of being the boss, we must also grant each one of our fellow citizens. So that's what makes it all work. Knowledge, respect, freedom for self, freedom for others, hard work, and pleasing each other to advance our own well-being. Now, how many times do you find such phrases as serve others, provide a service, and here to please and to serve in free enterprise? When one serves others, he serves himself as well. How very important the customer and consumer are. Our respect and our appreciation for the consumer is because each person is a consumer. We consume to live, and we help each other to live. Consumer sovereignty means the consumer is the boss. We serve and please each other. And in so doing, we exercise our freedoms to fulfill our own destiny, upgrade our own standard of living and quality of life. The customer pays the bill, and that's why the customer is the boss. Now, competition is a factor that comes in, and greater, regular, invisible enforcer, and it is a tough taskmaster. So, competition then instills in all of us a discipline. Word got around not only about the quality of my chairs, but also my obvious affluence from producing super chairs. And soon I had to outdo an old friend of mine who had helped me make chairs for a while. He became my competitor. He was very good at making chairs, and I know why. It's because I taught him everything that I know. not just the right materials and methods, but production efficiencies, product finishing, and quality control techniques. Now, not only did my friend produce a good product, but he offered his chairs at a lower price than my chairs. He did so to gain customers and a market share. So I had to reduce my prices in order to compete. That's what competition's all about. Now, competition isn't bad. Competition works in free enterprise, and it works for all of us. It is the discipline that comes into the free enterprise system that causes all of us to produce more for less, to work harder, and it keeps quality in the product. I was able to lower my prices because I had invested some of my profits in new machinery and equipment that does a better job at less expense. I can meet or beat his price, and I still make a good return even at the lower price. And I've noticed that when I have a sale, so does he. When he comes out with a new product design, so do I. So who benefits from all of this competition? Well, the same lucky persons, the queen and king of call customers. Because now they're getting more value, and they're paying less for it. Competition produces more at a lower price. So competition in the free market is the policeman. It is the great regulator. There are no armed guards, no need to survey my quality or prices, because my customers do that automatically. They insist on value and they settle for nothing less. So as long as the market is free and others can get into the market quickly and freely, I must produce a better chair and provide increased value or go out of business. Now, even if my competitor and I joined forces and jacked up prices, how long would that last? Well, someone else would realize the opportunities and potential rewards, and they would get into the business, and they'd love to please my customers. So being good at making chairs is not enough. I must always get better at making chairs, or I will perish in my business. Competition is the great regulator that keeps me in line. Competition keeps all of us lean and mean. It keeps all of us tough. At his lower prices, my competitor's business initially expanded and included his hiring one of my best employees because he paid higher wages. So I had to raise my employee wages too, and then add training programs and more benefits to obtain, retain, and maintain good people as employees. Now, it sounds almost too good to be true. Competition not only lowers prices and increases value, but it boosts jobs, increases wages, adds benefits, improves quality, sparks innovation, and design improvements. There is absolutely no outside force required to do what we set out to do in any way, and that is to please our customer. Competition, the invisible enforcer, does it all. Competition is a tough taskmaster. Competition requires hard work and smart work to maintain the business by pleasing customers in the present and in planning investment and innovation for the future. And it creates room for a lot of business enterprises and entrepreneurs in addition to all of the above. So when the public becomes aware of a good product or service, they want more of it. Those who let down, those who do not continue to please their customers, or those who skimp and take shortcuts soon pay the free enterprise price of mediocrity. They go out of business. Business failure is a serious price to pay, so serious that it makes people work and work very hard to keep their customers and to survive as a profitable business. And that's all we're dealing with here today in this climate of depression or this climate of recession. General Motors and Chrysler cannot compete with Toyota and Datsun, and they will go out of business. That's all. and somebody else will take their place. Well, somebody else that produces a better product at a lower price. The people who are put out of business at General Motors will then have to take a job over at Datsun or Toyota, whoever it is that takes the business. That's all that boils down to. As long as we maintain free enterprise. Now, when government interferes, now that's something different. Now, when government comes in, that's called fascism. Fascism. That distorts the marketplace. That gives us higher prices, fewer goods to choose from, creates monopoly, sets wages and prices, and it produces less over the long haul so that we can all stand in line and share the shortage and pay more for it. Now, that's the experience that we have from all of the isms. Now, we haven't learned much from free enterprise. The system that has worked so well and done so much for so long has been scrapped now in favor of fascism, in favor of communism, in favor of the new capitalism, government control, government bailouts. Well, we'll all have an opportunity to stand in line and share the shortage before long. But remember that a free market is not free. And the important to the idea of competition is free access to that market. That is, the ease of entry into and exit from the marketplace by the buyers, the producers, and the sellers. So if we use government to restrict the marketplace, to restrict competition, or if competition is thwarted and the benefits of competition become limited or eliminated, with competition controlled, government steps in with laws and regulations, law officers and bureaucrats to assure legal compliance. The courts, the legal system, become the new regulating mechanism. With such controls come reduced output, higher expense, higher prices, and lower availability and quality. Competition can really be restricted only by government. So let's use a taxi as an example. With freedom of entry, almost anyone could buy a car, call himself a taxi, and be in business for himself. For self-preservation, he'd have the integrity to assure safe, economical, and dependable transportation. And if he didn't, he'd soon be driven out of business by competition, because word gets around. Now, suppose the government began to license taxis to assure that the regulations were met and taxes were paid. Soon, one taxi service realized that regulation could do them a great deal of good. So suppose for the public good, only 20 taxis were permitted to exist to properly service a community. Then the free entry and exit of the taxi market has been eliminated through government. And so has competition. Only one group would benefit, the original and only taxi company that exists after the legislation was passed. So who do we suppose initiated, sponsored, and encouraged that legislation? That company has become a protected monopoly. The only kind of monopoly that can really exist is that monopoly that's created by government and controlled by force of law. That is not free enterprise. That's the bottom line. And that's what we have in America today. We have a free enterprise system that's gone haywire. That is, government comes in with regulations and controls, and they limit that marketplace. They limit competition. And when they do that, then they limit quality, increase prices, and then we get to bail it out. Isn't that just special? Hey, I'm out of time. I got to leave it right there. We'll take it up right here next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. But meanwhile, you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log, schedule, and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.